John, it's a great honour to be here in your studio in Great Totton. You're a very well-known sculptor and painter. Could you tell me a little bit about your early interest in art and your training?
It really starts very early because my father, early in the war, was sunk in the Norway campaign, was captured, escaped, and managed to intercept the last HMS Glasgow, which was the last ship out of Narvik. And after the war, he was keen to take my mother to see one of the more interesting aspects of his wartime experiences. He was very much helped by the Norwegian people, and he was interested to show her a little of the Norway that he'd experienced. And while they were there, and I would have been six or less, I stayed with the primary school head, and she had a friend called Michael Cardew, a very interesting and well-known potter. And I spent my time playing with clay. And he said, when he saw me absolutely absorbed in what I was doing, "You ought to be a sculptor." And my parents said, when they got back, the first words I said to them is, "I am going to be a sculptor." And for some reason or other, I never changed my mind. That was it as far as I was concerned.
Wonderful.
So I love clay.
Age of six, you had that interest. Yeah.
Well, clay is a very strange material. It's extremely responsive. You know, you can make it do almost anything. And it's a sort of spontaneous material. And the odd thing about the sort of sculpture that I have done for the most part is that it translates a very spontaneous material into something that is strangely durable. It's not the durability itself that particularly interests me, because people say, "Oh, it's wonderful to work with something that lasts so long." That's not really the point for me. It's translating something quite mercurial, spontaneous, into something which is static. It's a sort of frozen moment or a frozen experience. That's really the fascination for me.
So you never wavered in your ambition to be a sculptor?
Sadly, no.
Good. And that eventually went on to art college, presumably.
Yes. I was very determined about what I wanted to do. And my parents were not particularly enthusiastic. My mother was very much focused on steady, regular careers. Having a father who was rather mercurial and unreliable, she thought that something more dependable for her children would be a good idea. I couldn't agree with that. And I had a rather major falling out with them as a rather awkward teenager. And I spent a year working with community service volunteers when I was supposed to come to my senses. But I started attending the art school in Carlisle and then applied to Goldsmiths, which was before it became a very fashionable, trendy sort of art school to go to.
And how long before you got your first commission?
Well, in my, what it would be, I suppose it'd be, final year, just before my final year, I was offered an exhibition in London. And I leapt at the opportunity. And I went into that with an overdraft of £60. And I left after the end of the exhibition with a cheque for a little over £2,000, which in 1968 was quite a lot of money. And I thought, well, this is easy. And I didn't know what to do with the money. And by a stroke of luck, really, I bought a little house, number 10 London Road, in Malden, for £1,850.
Really?
Yes. And actually, that sort of chance almost really provided me with a degree of security. Because, I mean, when you're working on your own, it's, you know, as an artist, it's a business, you know, actually. And you have ups and downs, some very good years, some pretty rotten years. So not having to service a mortgage, which a lot of youngsters, is just awful problem for them.
So your first house was in Malden?
Yes, number 10 London Road. Very similar now to what it was then.
John, I have the impression that you're better known as a sculptor, but you also do beautiful paintings.
Well, basically, commissioned sculpture has been what's kept my circus on the road. But right from early on, painting has been important for me. Well, it's not just painting, drawing. And when at art school, Andrew Forge was appointed head of fine art at Goldsmiths, all of the old boys who'd been there before were sort of squeezed out. So their approach to teaching was very much based on teaching people the skills to make things, to, you know, drawing, some, you know, really rather old-fashioned teaching, which I have come to respect over the years, but also enjoyed at the time. When the idea of the creative process switched from the object to the concept, I found that quite a difficult thing. The idea was the important thing. It didn't matter who made it, if it was made well or badly. For me, the creative process is very much in the making. That is what sort of freezes the idea, the thought process. And I had this sort of, not quite crisis, but a desire to go back to the very, very simple. So I started, and this was while I was at Goldsmiths, and I'd had this offer of an exhibition. I started to paint very, very simple things, a jam jar with a few cigarette ends in it and a stone pot, and very, very simple objects, really to try and reduce, in my mind, the creative process to its essentials, which really is a sort of voyage of discovery. If you're not arriving at an unexpected destination, it's not really a creative process. It's a formula. So it was those very, very simple paintings of still lives, which really were the basis of my first exhibition, with a few bronzes, because I couldn't afford more than a few bronzes to cast them. And I have gone back to, particularly to still life painting, again and again, just, I mean, almost like scales and arpeggios, but it's an interesting discipline. It's not particularly popular. It's not particularly, you know, people, you know, still lives are not necessarily at the top of people's shopping lists. But for me, it's an interesting discipline. I'm also very interested in landscape. So human form and landscape seem to me to have similarities. People think of Essex as being flat, but it is not. You know, that sort of gentle rolling undulations of landscape, I think, are very, very like, you know, horizontal bodies. And I like that. And also, the fact that when you see landscape is very often informed by experiences. So quite a lot of my paintings have figures superimposed on landscape as sort of echoes of memories. And
do you paint in oil or watercolour or both?
Well, mainly oils, because I never know quite what I'm doing, and it gives you opportunities for revision, which I quite like. Actually, in watercolours, I do quite a lot of revision too. You know, overpainting and gouache and that sort of thing.
Going back to the sculptures, you're a figurative sculptor. So, I believe. So you concentrate mainly on people and animals, is that fair to say?
Well, all of my commissioned work is very definitely, has been, you know, mostly based on portraiture and figural representation. The sort of sculpture that I produce on my own account tends to be more strongly symbolic than representational, though most of the things that I do are representations of things. Mm. Though in recent years, I have been making sculptures of things that I have painted in still lives, which is a very peculiar thing to want to do, but it amuses me. I mean, just over here, for instance, I used to drink, well, I still drink, but I used to drink Dutch gin quite often, and there is an old Dutch gin bottle there in that bronze that has a face of my wife on it when we met at about that time, so that it's a bottle with a memory, if you see what I mean. And, you know, various things. I mean, here, for instance, is I've done quite a few sculptures that are incorporated, and paintings that have incorporated a hand grenade that my father used to keep on his desk. And I've always thought war is a rather strange thing that people seem to have to do. So here is a hand grenade that's been cut in half and bit into, and it's a strange appetite. And so there is, if you like, something that I have painted that has been given a symbolic meaning. It's perhaps, you know, something that people would find a little less easy to engage with, but I've got to a stage now where I don't care. I mean, one of the great things about being relatively, I don't think of myself as being particularly old, but a bit, you know, when you've gone a fair way down the tracks, it doesn't matter anymore. You know, I couldn't give a damn whether anybody likes what I do or not, because, you know, our children have grown up, we've got grandchildren, you know, haven't got a mortgage to service, and basically, you know, it's a matter of up to me what I choose to do.
You've done masses of portrait sculptures. I mean, to name a few, the Queen, the Duke of Edinburgh, Sir John Betjeman, the Beatles, Nelson Mandela, Dorothy Sayers, whose statue is in Witham. I presume that, if possible, you like to meet the person.
Absolutely. First. I mean, if they're alive,
exactly.
If they're alive. I mean, my memorial sculpture is really a matter of trying to recreate, in my mind, as close as it would be to meeting them. If you are lucky enough to meet somebody really astonishing, like Nelson Mandela, for instance. What I try and do is start without any preconceptions at all. So, you know, you're not meeting, well, in that case, he was recently out of prison. He was president of South Africa. And I try to forget all of that.
And you met him?
Yes. So try to forget all of that and just react to the personality, because the job of a portrait in my mind is to record the experience of the personality. The position actually is not important. The vital thing in terms of what the portrait does is to try and make the experience of their personality available to them. And I found Nelson Mandela very, very interesting and remarkable. He had been in prison for 27 years and he'd got out. He didn't want to be president because he'd achieved what he wanted to do, which was the end of apartheid. The relationship with his wife had fallen apart. So he was unhappy. He was depressed. And yet, when required, he inflated. He became what people were expecting him to be, which was very different. You know, the deflated balloon became, you know, an authority. He was very, he had a strong moral authority, a moral conviction, which gave him his power in prison. And actually, he was quite passive, I think, as a president, because I asked, if you didn't want to be president, why are you? And he said, well, people wanted me to. And there are big difficulties facing South Africa. And he said, in my position, if there is a smouldering ember which could become a conflagration, I am probably in a position to pour a cup of water on it and put it out. So he was definitely serving his people.
So you hold the memory of that person, of Nelson Mandela, for example, you hold the memory in your mind. Do you also take photos?
No, I don't tend to, because I think photographs are very overrated and they come come between you and the experience of seeing somebody. I mean, I don't have a mobile phone, I don't take photographs, never took photographs of my children when they were young, you know, fat, ugly toddlers. There's too many photographs of those in the world, and they don't really mean anything much anyway, except perhaps to their mothers. But, you know, I think that the living experience, people travel with cameras and they don't see anything because they're looking through their bloody, or taking selfies or God knows what. You know, living is more important.
Totally agree with you. I have to ask this. Did you meet the Queen?
Yes.
Did you? And the Duke of Edinburgh?
Yes.
That was a fantastic experience.
Well, I'm not really a monarchist. So I think it's a bit of a funny institution. The Queen has done what she regards as her job with remarkable diligence and application over a lifetime. But frankly, I think for a nation to have as its head of state somebody who just happens to be there because who their mother was, strikes me as rather odd. But, you know, that's a personal view.
We'll change the subject, John. I believe you worked in India for several months.
Well, I think it was about 4 months in India. I had an invitation to go and spend time. Well, I think it was a standing invitation for near enough 40 years to go there. But I've never really been much interested in travel. I've travelled a lot with work. Spent a lot of time in the States, for instance, with portraiture. But I've always found that travelling in your mind is really more interesting than going from place to place. But if I have, you know, been somewhere surprising, I have always enjoyed the experience. So that my long postponed invitation to work with indigenous bronze casters in India, that was why I went. And what really convinced me was I'd done some reading by anthropologists about the indigenous bronze casters, Adivasi bronze casters in India. And the people who were writing about it and recording it clearly had no understanding of this extraordinary process that had been handed down generation after generation, fingertip to fingertip, for thousands of years. You know, 4,000 years or something of continuous bronze casting in India among Adivasi people. Very, very simple, using indigenous materials. Very, very simple. And it's disappearing. And I thought that I would go and record. So I did take photographs. Well, actually, I didn't. I had a photographer with me taking photographs, Balumonde, recording, taking samples of materials, working with the older bronze casters, and working alongside them making things of my own and watching them make things. And the result of that is now in the Anthropology Museum in Cambridge. So, you know, it was an interest really in the casting process and the historical aspects of it that took me to India. And I formed a very deep respect for the Adivasi people in around Narayanpur, Jugdalpur, way, way off the tourist, you know, map, you know, no running water. It's just very, very simple life. Very hospitable, very generous, and very, very marginalised. The Adivasi people have a terrible time in India. Really very poor, and very little opportunity. But that is changing. And so these most interesting craftsmen are now basically no longer relevant, which is a shame.
Were they able to sell their work? Is that how they lived?
Well, the problem is that the traditional activities are no longer relevant. So, for instance, really ancient and interesting bronze cooking vessels are now melted down. You know, they're family heirlooms, you know, bangles, things as well as other scrap that they can get hold of, are melted down to make tourist junk, which is sold in the state shops, state-run shops. So all of the, for instance, the local gods, which featured in their sculptures traditionally, are no longer relevant. All people just want Sai Baba and Ganesh and, you know, things that really are not relevant to the local peoples, the local deities. It was very interesting.
Yeah, sounds it, really.
But my wife went home after a couple of months. Because it wasn't much of a tourist experience, and she really didn't have anything particularly to do. She was based in Indore, which is, you know, not top of people's tourist lists.
Let's come back to Malden and the very famous statue of Britannoth at the end of the promenade extension in the park. I understand it took a long time in the planning and the preparation.
Well, it was first mooted. I was talking to a councillor, I can't remember who it was. And I was interested in the Saxons and Malden history. I'm a bit of a history and Essex and local history nut. I collect books and I'm always been interested. And the Saxon heritage, I think, is very interesting. In a conversation with someone, I honestly can't remember. This would have been in about 1977, early 70s, I would say. It was proposed as an idea. And I produced a head of Britannoth, which I thought large could go on the end of the promenade, because his head was taken away by the Vikings and his body was buried in Ely Cathedral with a lump of wax to replace the head. It was excavated in the 19th century and he was found to have been enormously tall, and, you know, it was all interesting. And this was an idea, and anyway, the idea didn't fly, but sort of lingered somewhere somewhere in the offing. So from time to time, people said, oh, you know, how about that idea of a Britannoth? And the present form of it was really... commissions are quite interesting because they involve a journey. A successful commission is really should be a surprise to the client and a surprise to the sculptor in a way, because what is needed is what is needed rather than what somebody thinks they want. And the vertical aspect of Britnoth, which at the time was controversial, was decided on because that was something that people could identify with as a marker. So one of the problems with the promenade extension, as it was people would meander along there and sort of give up because there was nothing, you know, they'd sort of get about halfway and then they'd go, oh, God, what's the point of this? And then they'd wander back. Whereas the object of the exercise was to provide a marker for people so that the very least they could do is walk out to the end of the promenade extension, walk round it and come back.
As they do in their thousands. Yes.
Well, it's really an exercise
yes,
aid.
It is. Who commissioned you for this?
Well, there were several attempts to put it together, and then a little group of people with Kathleen Nolan as the chair of this little group decided to try and raise money to get this project off the ground. Mm. And after several false starts, you know, the idea was to do it for the millennium. I think it went up in about 2005, something like that. Mm. Struggled its way to a completion, you know.
So you were quite inspired by this Anglo-Saxon fighter, tall, elderly,
well,
actually.
Yes.
Wasn't he?
What impresses me about Britnoth is that his money was where his mouth is. As the leader of the, effectively, the anti-appeasement group and the court of King Ethelred, he saw this constant paying of Danegelt to get the Vikings to go away. I mean, it was nonsense. There's more Saxon coinage in Scandinavia to this day than there is in England. So, you know, you can't keep going. So his idea was to confront the threat and to try and do something about it. Now, instead of getting somebody else to do it, he was at the forefront himself. And he made his immediate elves to support him in this. You know, they dismounted and confronted the enemy. My idea is that anybody who thinks a war is a good idea should be the first person to die, to guarantee that it's a cause worth dying for. We don't see many politicians in these foreign adventures that we've got involved with sacrificing their own lives or endangering themselves for projects that have probably got more to do with their ego and, you know, diversion of attention from local, you know, their domestic problems.
Britnoth stands on a large plinth, mm-hmm. which shows various Anglo-Saxon scenes and words at the bottom, "Grant, O Lord, thy grace," which I understand was one of the last few words that is from his
prayer.
Right, yes.
On the eve of the battle.
Right, okay.
And I think that is very moving, that someone is prepared to confront death in a cause in which they believe. And I think that the idea of, you know, grace accompanying somebody on the journey into the unknown, death, is quite comforting in a way, because, you know, the one thing that lies at the end of life is something that we can't know. And that's what makes life valuable and special. I love the fact that life is finite. That's what gives it its value. I think it was Seneca who said that what gives humanity precedence over the gods is their mortality, because you have to reconcile yourself to the finite condition of life.
Was the design, both of the statue but of the plinth as well, was it completely up to you?
No.
Did anybody else throw in ideas?
Of course.
Right.
And it's a compromise. It is not quite what I would have had, but I think the fact that it was the planning permission that was the great difficulty, because there were councillors, notably Rodney Bass, was fiercely against it because he thought it was a waste of money. But the fact is that it's not a single penny of public money went into it. So quite why people were so exercised by that, I don't know. Mm. And yet, a few weeks after it went up, there he was claiming credit for it himself. You see, but politicians are a funny lot.
Yeah. You must be very pleased and proud of it.
Well, not really, because...
Everybody else is.
Well, I think there's always the next job that is... The challenge, the interesting thing. I've never really been obsessed. I can always see what's wrong with something. And so it's the next one that's going to be the triumph in my life. Mm. You know, I always confront work and think, oh, crikey, why didn't I do this or that or the other? Whereas the next job is going to be the, you know, perfection. But, of course, it can never be. It's like climbing a hill. You know, the summit is always a little bit further on.
It's a very large figure, as was Sherlock Holmes that you did in Baker Street. Are they two of the largest that you've done?
There's quite a large thing down in Bristol, outside the Phoenix Building. In Fiji, there's a heroic scale figure of Rata Sukuna. The size of a thing is very much dependent on the site. You were talking earlier about a job I recently did at St Mary's. Mm. Now that is quite an intimate thing because it is in the centre of a place for the interment of ashes. It is a contemplative space. Mm. So it's almost, the relationship is almost like reading a book, whereas Britnoff stands out sort of bold at the end, making a statement, I think, about valour and values. In at St Mary's, the metaphor, I mean, you know, the River Blackwater has been a part of my life. I was born in Langford. And I basically lived almost all of my life in Essex. I have a great respect for the county. I think it is a wonderful county. We're privileged to live in it. I love its diversity. You know, you've got the sort of, you know, the wheelers and dealers of South Essex, and you've got the wonderful coast, and you've got deeply rural bits. There's manufacturing. It's a very open and diverse county. It is a friendly county. People who've moved to Essex say that it's the friendliest place that they have lived. And I think that the history is very special in Essex, and I think that is one of the reasons why I think people like to denigrate it, is because I think that people who come from Essex tend to be proud of the fact.
The statue in St Mary's that you've just referred to, of course, is the sundial.
Yeah.
Just fairly recently put in place.
Yeah.
Right in the churchyard.
Hmm.
With four sides representing different aspects of the River Blackwater.
Well, it is traces. It's a map, basically speaking, starting at the source, travelling, you know, through the course of the river and right out into the open sea. And it seems to me that is a metaphor for life. We have a source, and we end up in, well, depending on your point of view, is the openness of the ocean. I mean, you might see that as the communion of saints. You might see that as, well, whatever you envisage comes at the end of life. It's like the open sea. It's a journey. And for me, the Blackwater is a river of life, though sadly less a river of life than it used to be because of the pollution and all of the things that have happened during my lifetime. So, you know, the crabbing and the little creatures that always used to be found on the shore are now, for some reason, absent. And I think that's rather sad.
I'd like to, John, just mention the Mayflower sculpture that's in Billericay.
Yes.
I think that was put in place again last year.
Yes, that was last year.
There's a video on your website showing you very much involved in the placing of it.
Well, I'd like to be involved from the start to finish. I mean, you know, I interfere with the whole process right from the very start right to the very end. That's what I do.
Yeah. So you were helping to manhandle it, weren't you, into position?
Yes.
And
well, because, you know, you have ownership of the job.
Yeah. And you were pleased with that?
Well, the funny thing about that was that I was speaking to a cousin, because I have American cousins, and I said, well, you know, it's quite fun. I've been given a job. My grandmother's family are all in New England, and there's a sort of strong New England, you know. I'm really proud of the fact that my forebears fought for American independence. I just love it. You know, a Prudence Cummings, heroine of the revolution. You know, I think they're my favourite forebears, really. I was commissioned to do this. I thought that was sort of interesting and appealed to me. A cousin said, you realise we are descended from two people who sailed on the Mayflower. I had absolutely no idea. So, Sarah White, her husband died in the first winter. 120 people sailed on the Mayflower. 47 survived the first winter because they had no food and no shelter, basically speaking. Richard Brewster's wife died. They got together and produced several children from whom my grandmother's family had descended. And that's, so all of the people on represented on that schematic representation of the Mayflower are descendants of people who sailed in the Mayflower.
Very special. Yeah.
And that was just such fun. Yeah. And in a way, the most annoying thing of all was the fact that somebody in my wife's family had done some family research and discovered that she also is descended, which was a great disappointment to me because her Scottish, she's Scots, so her ancestors were involved in the tobacco trade and they had, to their shame, tobacco plantations in North Virginia. And they... I think it was his second wife, he married an American who was the descendant of the young girl who was credited with the first person of stepping ashore from the Mayflower onto the Plymouth Rock. Well, so our children are completely, completely Mayflower products.
Excellent. Okay, so finally, living here in Great Totham, super place to live, isn't it?
Well, I love it. The fact that I love it is probably rather obvious because we live in the house which my parents lived in and which I lived in from... I was born in Langford, but my parents moved from the old rectory to here in 1962. And the old rectory was a less practical house, and I'm really grateful to them for having made that move. When my parents died, I was bought out, my siblings, because I thought I would rather live somewhere that I was very fond of and liked, rather than have the money.
And you've got space and outbuildings here for your studio, so
it's absolutely. I mean, I've got this is a sort of main studio, but I've got the clay studio next door and a little drawing studio, so it's absolutely ideal.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much indeed, John.
No, it's been my pleasure.
It's been fascinating listening to you. Thank you.